Thanks for tuning in for the October 29th podcast. I'm Bob Gross, editor-in-chief of the Neurology family of journals, Neurology, Neurology Genetics, Neurology Neuroimmunology and Neuroinflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice. This week's featured interview highlights autologous non-myeloablative hemopoietic stem cell transplantation for neuromyelitis optica. In the What's Trending segment, you'll hear the first part of an interview with writer Lawrence Wexler about his biography of Oliver Sacks.
This is Stacey Clardy. Today I'm talking with Dr. Richard Burt. He's a hematologist and chief of the Division of Immunotherapy at Northwestern University in Chicago. We're going to talk about his paper in the Neurology Journal titled Autologous Non-Myeloablative Hemopoietic Stem Cell Transplantation for Neuromyelitis Optica. Richard has, of course, been involved in stem cell transplantation for autoimmune and neurologic diseases for decades at this point, and he's really pioneered the study of transplant for these non-malignant conditions. I know he's faced a great deal of pushback and skepticism, especially in the early years. More recently, we've seen his work come out in multiple sclerosis and now in the neurology field, this paper on NMO. So welcome, Richard, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So for this open label study, you enrolled 13 patients. As I understand it, 11 were aquaporin 4 positive NMO patients, one was seronegative or did not have aquaporin 4, and one was a really complicated NMO patient who had aquaporin 4 positivity but severe lupus sort of concomitant with it. So of these 13 patients, did it work? Is non-myeloablative stem cell transplantation an effective treatment option for NMOSD?
In that group that we performed it, the one patient with severe lupus, neuropsychiatric lupus, pulmonary involvement, renal involvement, so forth, actually 10 months later went on to die from complications of her lupus. So, you know, she is not a part of the data here because there's no follow-up, and we explain that in the article. But I actually feel her disease is totally different than the typical NMO aquaporin 4 positive patient. Of the remaining 12, including the one that was negative, they all got better. But of those that were aquaporin 4, 11 of them, 9 became negative by the next time we checked the aquaporin 4 titer, which was 6 months or 1 year. And those that became negative never had a relapse, never required any further therapy, and improved and stayed better for the 5 years we followed them. The two who initially improved but did not become negative in the aquaporin 4 antibody relapsed within 2 years, one at 18 months, one at 24 months, and had to go back on therapy. They're doing fine. You know, they're alive, but they had to get back on therapy as you would normally treat this disease. So the exciting thing is, well, it's not randomized. There's no comparator, but 9 of the 11 became antibody negative by the assay available at the time that was performed at Mayo Clinic. And they improved when intermission, no further treatment, and have not had a relapse or deterioration over the 5 years they've been followed. Now, that's very encouraging, but, you know, we always put the caveat in there. It needs to be reconfirmed by other centers. And I think, however, this provides motivation for other people to look into this type of treatment for neuromyelitis optica.
I think it's really exciting. And as you alluded to, you were enrolling for a long period of time here between 2008 and 2016. And over that period of time, you fortunately stored some samples because the sensitivity and the specificity of the aquaporin 4 assays improved and changed over that time. So for our listeners, the details around which assays were done and then all of the samples on whom the most up-to-date flow cytometry assay were performed are all in the paper. We don't have to get into that. But I do think it's important to highlight that these were really ill patients that you transplanted. You did exclude those who couldn't ambulate with a walker, but still, for 12 of the patients with NMO, the mean duration of disease was 84 months. They had quite a few attacks. So the mean number of neurologic relapses was 4.3. They had tried various treatments. The average number they tried before transplant was 4. And in terms of what kind of attacks they were having, all 12 of the ones that you ultimately included in the analysis had a myelitis. One had area postrema, and they were really quite ill. Also, other things I guess we should mention, 8 were Caucasian, 4 were African American, and the average age was 42, so between 19 and 51. So this really was quite a sick group of patients that you still had this overall positive outcome in. So what were the side effects in this very sick group of patients, and how did you counsel the patients on the risks?
Well, so everything is done through a consent approved by the IRB, and the consent, of course, is written at a sixth grade level that emphasizes toxicity, including a possibility of mortality. I mean, that's very clearly put out there. All possible side effects, infertility, hair loss, so forth, infections. And those risks are repeated by the study nurse and by myself when we evaluate the patient. What I've found, surprisingly, is that the patients who come to us, maybe because we kind of ended up being almost a quaternary referral center for these individuals, you know, they want this, and where they're upset is when we say no, not when we go through explaining all the risks. They seem very much aware of that, but the risks of continuing in this disease is worse for them, and, you know, they don't want to end up in a bed or permanently in a wheelchair or permanently blind. So for the patients suffering from this disease in their shoes, what I found is when we go through the risk, they find the risk of the disease much worse, and they want to do this. Now, I don't believe we had any grade 4 toxicity. I'd have to go back and double-check the paper. We score toxicities during treatment by NCI criteria of grade 1, 2, 3, 4. We did have some grade 3 from electrolytes or fever or whatever. Those are kind of expected. We had no serious infections. And after the discharge, we had no serious infections I can remember. Again, I'd have to go back to the paper, but nothing very notable. There was a patient that did get some recurrent upper respiratory tract infections, and the immunoglobulins were quite low. And we did give some IVIG to prevent those for about 18 months, and then we're able to stop it, and the patient's immunoglobulins had recovered.
Okay, it's good to know. Our audience is mostly neurologists. So can you tell us what transplant regimen you used and how that differs from other approaches, for example, those used in some of the studies that were done on multiple sclerosis?
Right. So for multiple sclerosis, we used cyclophosphamide and ATG, 5 days of ATG, 4 days of cyclophosphamide. But what I have found, because we've done several different immune-mediated autoimmune diseases, is that for each disease, the regimen has to be tailored for that disease, as well as selection of patients. From our experience in some other diseases, these antibody-mediated disorders, we felt it was important to add to the Cytoxan ATG Rituxan, which we did, and we just threw in plasmapheresis one time on the day of admission just to try to lower the titer to avoid any kind of flare while we're going through the process. I don't know that we would have one, but we just did that as a safety precaution.
Sure. So understood, this is really a customized approach. And when we read and compare and contrast these papers internationally, it's really important, if I hear what you're saying, to be absolutely certain of what regimen they're following and compare apples to apples in terms of regimen and level of disability going in.
No, you're absolutely right. I think a lot of people hear the word stem cell transplant and they think it's all the same. They think the effector cell is a stem cell, and it is not. The efficacy and toxicity is from the conditioning regimen you use. That is the regimen to condition the immune system. And so what you have to do is think about what that regimen is, and you're going to get different results with different regimens as well as different selection of patient groups.
Let's talk cost. I'm interested to know what the approximate cost of this procedure is in today's dollars. And I should preface that question by saying this is our second podcast this month on NMOSD. We did talk to Sean Pittock earlier this month on the 8th about his New England Journal paper on the approval of eculizumab for treatment of NMOSD, the first drug we've ever had approved by the FDA for NMO. So in that context, eculizumab costs about $500,000 annually in the U.S., and of course, this is not a one-time cost. It's $500,000 each year you're on that medication. So how does transplantation, as you designed it, cost, and how does that compare?
So the cost of this regimen is approximately $125,000. That's a one-time cost. You're done. But it was actually Sean then that I dared to go back and recheck with more sensitive fax assay and do the cell killing. He was very excited about this, given the fact he had also just been first author in the eculizumab study. And it's very clear his goal is simply to help patients with NMO, not to have a bias towards any one type of therapy. So here's the first author in eculizumab, the last author in my paper, and actually the one that gave me the idea, and then independently repeated the assays using fax and doing the cell killing, which kind of strengthens the paper considerably that you have another center with no iron in the fire on this type of therapy, having just actually come out to get the first drug FDA approved for NMO eculizumab, confirming these results.
So you said in the future, if you would see someone who didn't go antibody negative or who is still able to activate complement on these assays, you would maybe consider restarting immunotherapy, which leads me to the question, is transplant something that NMO patients can still have done at your site or elsewhere? Is it available if patients want this?
Yeah, so what I'm doing right now is I'm winding my transplants down and try to finish everything by the end of this year. So next year I'm doing a sabbatical to focus on getting, we have a lot of data that we're very much behind on getting out. It's very hard to do when you have very active service, and I'm the only clinical physician for that service. You know, the whole reason for doing this for the last 25 years is not to make everybody come to Northwestern, but to get other people to start doing this at their centers so patients can go locally to have it done. And I would think these results, as well as our results in MS, will get further studies going in this field, hopefully. The problem with our NMO paper, it's a small number of patients, very encouraging, but a small number. And so it needs to be confirmed by other centers, maybe hopefully even in a comparative trial to perhaps eculizumab or whatever. But, you know, the goal isn't for us to hoard this, but to get other places to do it.
Understood. And you make a really compelling argument on multiple levels for hopefully inspiring some other groups to pursue this and add to the data around the world. Give patients more options if they want to pursue this angle. I think in the MS experience, we found that this is the right choice for some patients. This is what they want. They don't want lifelong therapy and they want to go for this. So we obviously need to learn more. I want to thank you again, Richard, for taking the time to discuss this study on autologous non-myeloablative hematopoietic stem cell transplantation for neuromyelitis optica. And thank you really for all the pioneering and very difficult work you've done across disciplines studying stem cell transplantation in autoimmune and immune-mediated neurologic diseases. Thank you.
No, thank you so much.
This is Stacey Clardy. I'm speaking with Lawrence Weschler today about the book he's just recently published about Oliver Sacks, titled, And How Are You, Dr. Sacks? Lawrence, you first met Oliver Sacks in the early 1980s when you started working on a profile of Dr. Sacks for a piece for The New Yorker. It was, I think, almost a decade after Oliver Sacks had published his now famous book, Awakenings, but perhaps before it really took off. You were 29, you were on staff at The New Yorker, and as I understand it, you spent 4 years intensively interviewing Oliver Sacks and the important figures in his life. You even rounded with him at the hospital, and you wrote a several-part series. But I guess we find out in this book, you didn't publish it at his request, and we'll get into that in a bit. But then you went on to remain good friends with him. He's your daughter's godfather, I believe. So this book sort of surveys his life, right, but heavily focuses on those 4 years when he was relatively unknown but on the verge of his fame, correct?
Yeah, exactly. Those turn out, in retrospect, to be very much the hinge years of his life. He was in the midst of what would become a 10-year writer's block in the wake of the publication and reception of Awakenings. The way his writer's block took form, he was trying to write about an incident in his own life that had happened after he wrote Awakenings, where he had been badly injured in an accident in Norway. He had lost the sensation of his leg for a period and had a tremendous existential crisis and was trying to write about it, trying to write about being a patient himself. Once he got through the blockage, the other stuff would take the form, for starters, of the bestseller, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. And after that, he was very well known. But during that period, he was very, very neurotic, knotted up, quite crazy at times, and it was quite a ride to be with him. I jokingly say that I was a beanpole Sancho to his capacious Quixote during those years. And so that's the background.
So let's back up a little bit. You alluded to this, the book that was the subject of the 10-year-long writer's block, which was ultimately called A Leg to Stand On. During that time, he was writing about this experience. And I think, you know, when questioned, people said, well, did you have a hysterical paralysis, as it was called at the time? Would call it, now that we know more about it, a functional neurologic paralysis, if that's fair. But certainly there was a lot of stigma at the time, and he really resisted that. But as time passed, and I think he talked a bit more about it, this really was perhaps a neurologist writing about a highly stigmatized condition at the time and his experience with it. Did you talk to him much about that aspect?
Oh, we talked about it all the time. I mean, not directly in those terms, but I think a huge reason why the book was so difficult for him to write was precisely, basically, the way Awakenings had been received by neurologists, in particular, by his fellow neurologists. Which is to say that, I mean, just to give you some idea, I interviewed the publisher of the book in England in 1982. The book Awakenings was published in 1973. He had done a hardcover edition of 1,500 books, which in 1982 had still not sold out, the first edition. There had been various paperback attempts at other publishers, but they likewise had not done particularly well. And the reason was that Sachs was dismissed, to the extent that he was known at all, he was dismissed in those days as being a romantic, as having made it up, as certainly not having done it the way it was supposed to be done. In other words, in those days in particular, at a moment when the 19th century tradition of case studies had virtually completely fallen away, the proper way was with double-blind studies and with all sorts of quantified charts and with peer review coming up through the appropriate journals, and Sachs had just not done any of that. W.H. Auden, Frank Kermode, various literary types were completely ravished by the book and celebrated it. But among doctors, and this really mattered to him, both of his parents were doctors, medicine was his life, the fact that he was dismissed just ate at him. And now to be writing the next book about an equally strange thing in which his account was equally stigmatized, in which was just proving to be incredibly difficult for him.
So this is something that when I read it, it surprised me, but I guess it really shouldn't have. But, you know, I'm a product of my time. He was already legend by the time I became a neurologist. But this really resonated with me, and I suspect it does with many of us in the field. Because on a smaller scale, we're often subjected to rejection on many levels, right? Whether it be rejection from our approaches to patient care, our idea of what's best for the patient, or the deeper cuts, you know, that a harsh peer review of a paper or a grant proposal can inflict. Can you tell us what you saw in Oliver from this rejection and what impact it ultimately had on him?
It didn't take the form of him feeling, you know, talking about it all the time, but it was clear that it was at the base of why he was having so much trouble writing the other book, that fear of just not being believed, of being dismissed as a romantic, as a confabulator, and so forth. The incredible thing, as you suggest in the question, by the way you asked the question, is how things changed. At the end of the book, I talk about how on his 80th birthday, the chair of neurology at Columbia's teaching hospital reported, people would gather to celebrate Oliver, that nowadays, fully 70% of doctors applying for residency in the program mention Oliver Sachs. And specifically mentioned the kind of medicine he tries to do as their reason for having gone into neurology. The way Oliver would put it would be that you're not interested in the disease the patient has, but rather the patient who has the disease. I asked him if he'd ever thought about being any other kind of doctor. And he looked at me incredulous. He said, I mean, you know, I suppose I could be a cardiologist, but the heart is just a pump. You know, why would I be interested in that? That the only medicine that a thinking person would want to gravitate toward would be precisely the one that deals with the individual person in the entirety of their existential situation. He used to say that he was interested in the struggle between fate and freedom. Being a clinical ontologist meant for him that the diagnostic question was always, how are you? What is it like to be you? How do you be? And in some ways, I mean, with this book, I'm trying to turn that question back on Oliver and say, how are you, Dr. Sachs?
That's great. I was going to ask you about the title, and that explains it perfectly. And I love the quotes you're saying about how he views being a neurologist as sort of a thinking man. And there was another one you also had in the book where he says, I mean, really, I never meant to become a neurologist. I was meant to be a naturalist. I got deflected into medicine, into neurology, so that I had to treat neurology as if I were a naturalist. And I love all these quotes. They resonate, I think, with neurologists and what inspired us to go into the field, too. But it makes me wonder, could Oliver Sachs exist as a practicing clinician today in today's healthcare environment? What do you think?
Well, I mean, the answer is, until a few years ago, he was existing. Up until the age of 82, he was doing so. And, I mean, he was a very unusual person. One of the reviews of Awakenings I remember was an English neurologist said, well, of course, you know, if you're going to spend hours and hours with the patients, you can do this kind of medicine, but real people can't do this kind of thing. And he would spend hours, even though he was only being paid for 15 minutes, and the clinic itself was, so he was a problem doctor there. But generally speaking, and he talks about this at some length in the book, the whole introduction of Medicare and regulations and so forth. And also, it became problematic in this regard. It's also the case that long afterwards, you know, when he was famous and when millionaires would contact him and want to have appointments, you know, hour-long things with him, he tended not to do that because he tended to gravitate toward state hospitals, toward poor houses, I guess you could say, toward, you know, Little Sisters of Mercy, the back wards. You're not going to make millions of dollars with this kind of practice. But you're going to live a life, he would say, at the very frontier of what is most important about existence. And he didn't need millions of dollars. He lived a modest life even later when he was famous.
So maybe part of it is he really, by virtue of not being materialistic, he removed a lot of the constraint by not worrying as much about the money. Less of an emphasis on money could allow one to hopefully capture a bit of the practice style.
Yeah, and could help you stay focused on why it was that you went into medicine in the first place, he would say.
Right. So Oliver Sacks died on August 30th, 2015. It's been 4 years. My question for you, and maybe part of what made you release the book now, is how do we keep his legacy alive as neurologists? What part of his legacy do we incorporate into our practice?
One of the things I wanted to do with the book is, at this point, things have gone so far in the other direction, the level of hagiography, you know, all the stuff that we remember about how wonderful he was and how humane and how powerfully founded a whole new kind of neurology, which is very important. All that is true. It's also true that he was a very complicated person. And part of what I wanted to do, a little bit of this, is a corrective to show you that he was, in addition to being this wonderful person, he was completely exasperating. And he was so neurotic and so completely, in many ways, tough on himself and so forth and locked up and subject to unbelievable blockages and unbelievable explosions of energy and so forth. So in part, I'm trying to do a corrective of who he was and describe the man in full. Having said that, I think the issue about his credibility is not a minor one. He would be the first to say that all the numbers, all the charts and so forth are obviously important. And he became, by virtue of the requirements of Medicare and so forth, a spectacularly good reader of EEGs and things like that, you know. But that his focus on what you might call, one of the people I talked to describes it, he became focused on the community of the refused, on extreme cases. He had had various reasons in his life to be knotted and often inarticulate and often subject to terrible lassitudes or things like that. And he could relate to these people who were often just kind of dismissed as hopeless cases. And not only relate to them, but have incredibly powerful existential encounters with them.
With those thoughts, we conclude part one of our interview with Oliver Sacks' lifelong friend and biographer, Lawrence Weschler. We'll pick back up with the rest of our discussion in the next podcast, so be sure to join us next week.
This is Bob Gross again. Please check out this week's journal, which features a study on acute vestibular migraine treatment with non-invasive vagus nerve stimulation, and another article looking at how self-management programs improve participation in patients with neuromuscular disease. Please take a look at these and other articles in this week's issue. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.